Hello and welcome to Out in the Bay, gay radio from San Francisco. I'm Marilyn Pittman. Tomorrow the Olympics start in Sochi, Russia. Vladimir Putin has cracked down on gay rights or gay expression or behavior of any kind there. Will it be safe to be a gay tourist there or gay athlete there? What are the American multinational companies that sponsor the Games saying about pouring money into a country that as of last summer had put in place draconian anti-gay laws? And why didn't the attempts at boycotts of their products work? We'll take a look at the situation with my guest. His book, Cracks in the Iron Closet, broke ground, new ground, almost 20 years ago as it detailed LGBT life in the former Soviet Union. His health reporting is featured in the New York Times, Mother Jones, Slate, Salon, and many other news sites. He's currently the academic coordinator for the master's program in public health and journalism at UC Berkeley. David Teller, welcome to Out in the Bay.
Thanks, Marilyn.
So you have gay friends in Russia now for more than 20 years.
Yep.
What's life like for them there now? Has it changed? Is it worse because of these laws last summer?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think it's changed in any direct way. I mean, the government, you know, is not breaking into people's homes who are just sitting home quietly. So my friends are nervous about what's going to happen or what's been happening and what's likely to happen after the Olympics or could happen after the Olympics.
It's like Russia's waiting until after the Olympics to really be more violent.
Very possible. You know, we don't really know. We don't really know what's going to happen after the Olympics. We do know that he's on his best behavior now. I mean, this is his best behavior, so imagine what his worst behavior is.
Scary.
And, you know, he doesn't want any trouble at the Olympics. He doesn't want gay people being beat up at the Olympics or any kind of
bad trouble. Press.
Yeah, he doesn't want that. So,
well, your friends have, you know, struggled over this 20-plus years you've known them.
Right.
What's the arc of that 20 years for them? I mean, has it gotten easier and easier and looser and more westernized as the country changed and now it's tightening up?
Well, it's not quite that simple. It's not quite that sort of direct. There have been a lot of ups and downs over the last 20 years. I first went through in early 90s when it was still the Soviet Union and sort of all fell apart in the fall of 91. At that time, it was, there was an outpouring of sort of attention and sort of there had been a lot of press, you know, new press and sort of people were able to speak freely and see movies and stuff like that that was going on in the early 90s. And then there was a lot of pressure on Russia after the fall of the Soviet Union to remove its, sodomy law, basically. The law basically was focused specifically on sex between men. It didn't mention women. So lesbianism technically was not against any law.
Invisible as usual.
Women, of course, can't have sex unless a man's there somewhere. In 1993, under a lot of pressure from the West, Yeltsin and the Russian government removed the sodomy law. So at that point, theoretically, they were freer, quote, freer there than we were in the United States, where a lot of states still had sodomy laws that were actually in effect. But, you know, it was never good for gay people. It was just that...
Well, you weren't visible. You didn't walk down the streets holding hands. They didn't have a San Francisco where you could do that.
Right. They didn't... It wasn't really that kind of thing, although people did, you know, were able to sort of, you know, more or less have quietly open lives. And some people were activists, but other people more just sort of lived, you know, their neighbors knew, people knew, but people didn't talk about it. It was kind of like a don't ask, don't tell situation. Hmm. But that sort of really did change into the 90s as there were more, you know, gay clubs were much more open. It used to be that gay places were a little more secretive or they were known to be gay, but nobody really called them gay. But now there were gay discos and nightclubs and, you know, those things are still operating. It's not like those things have shut down.
Uh-huh.
Homosexuality is not illegal in Russia. Just propagandizing it to minors is illegal.
Uh-huh.
What that means, nobody really knows.
Do you think this crackdown last summer that Putin initiated, do you think part of it is just a reaction to gay rights kind of growing in Russia? There began to be gay rights parades. There was the pussy riot thing we'll get to in a bit. But there began to be a loosening up, and there was actual activists. And do you think it's a reaction to the fact that there was more openness and they were more fearless about standing up for themselves?
Well, I wouldn't necessarily put it in that way. There were a lot of activists who were very fearless in the 90s as well and in the early 2000s. So there wasn't a sort of an upsurge, I think, of activism. I think there just was more a resurgence of Putin's power and ability to do this. I think also it's important to note that it didn't start last summer. Russians had been expecting this because for the last 2 years before that, different cities and regions around the country had passed their own kind of anti-gay propaganda laws. And the most famous one was about a year and a half before St. Petersburg had passed such a law. But that was already after half a dozen other places around the same time. So mm-hmm. at this point, by the time they passed the law last summer, there were about 10 or 12 different regions that had passed laws. And once it passed in St. Petersburg, a lot of people thought, okay, it's going to be a national law. So people were kind of preparing for it or expecting mm-hmm. it to happen. It got attention in the West only last summer, but it had really been creeping up for a couple of years.
I see. Well, that's not widely known.
Yeah, well, it was something that was not much reported about.
This is sort of like the Defense of Marriage Act and how that sort of snowballed and...
Well, I think
many more states kept creating that kind of legislation, and it became pretty popular to do that statewide.
Yeah, I think it was something like that. I think they were, in Russia, these regions do things more as kind of trial balloons. Nobody really does something completely independently. So, who knows what was really going on or why were they introducing it little by little around the country? Who knows?
My guest is David Teller. He is the coordinator of the master's program in public health and journalism at UC Berkeley, the author of Cracks in the Iron Closet about LGBT life behind the Iron Curtain back in the 90s,
right,
pretty much.
The immediate post-Soviet era.
Well, tell me about, what do you know about Sochi itself? What kind of a place is that? What kind of a... I mean, I know it's going to give it a lot of infrastructure and economy now.
Right. Or something.
What was it known for before this Olympics focus?
Well, ironically, it was known in the 80s and 90s. It was known as a place where gay men would go to cruise in the summer. It's a beach resort, basically. So it's on the Black Sea,
like Fire Island.
Yeah, it's like the Pines. It's like the Fire Island Pines of Russia. So
really,
yes, really,
Sochi.
Yeah, it isn't now, but it was.
It was then.
Yeah, I mean, for their kind of version of that. It wasn't like the Pines is all gay men, but I mean, this was mostly not gay men, but there was. Known to be a gay contingent and mm-hmm. an area where people could cruise. And so the idea that it's now sort of the site of the Olympics with this whole gay thing, happening is just kind of ironic in that way. It's a pretty big city. It's about 300,000 people or something like that.
Oh.
But the area is a lot bigger. And it's on the Black Sea, so it's a beach resort, but the beaches are, not really, they're sort of pebbly. I'm sure, the Russian... the Kremlin always, Kremlin people always had dachas down by there, so I'm sure they had very nice.
What's
beaches.
A dacha? For those
that
don't
know. A dacha is like if you're a normal Russian person, it's like a little shack or a shed in the countryside. Maybe you have a cot there. If you're a rich person, it's like a huge, mansion in the countryside.
Summer home.
A summer home.
Mm-hmm.
Or a country place. So the Olympics, these are the Winter Olympics, not the Summer Olympics, there are mountains. It's sort of nestled between the Black Sea and these big mountains, and so that's where there has always been skiing in that area and stuff. So mm-hmm. most of the events are taking place in the mountains, not actually in Sochi.
In Sochi, right. You'd also done a story about this questionnaire. Tell me about the questionnaire.
Oh, right. So when I went there in the summer of 1991, I met a graduate student from Columbia University who was doing graduate work in sociology. He had gone there to do some economic sociology research, and while he was there, he decided to switch his dissertation to gay stuff. Gay issues. And so he was in Sochi with some friends, like in May or something of 1991, and he drew up a questionnaire for sociology research and was distributing it to men that he saw that he presumed were gay on the beach or wherever in Sochi. And somehow the local police got wind of this, and they picked him up, and they were questioning him, and nothing happened to him. He got let go. But anyway, in the papers, it was reported that he was the American sex spy in Sochi. And so when I then came to Russia, and I was started to do interviews with my gay and lesbian friends, and about their sex lives and all this kind of stuff, they just started laughing, said, "Oh, you're the American sex spy." So that was kind of like my nickname. Oh, the sex spy is at work again, doing another interview.
Are they privy to news stories like we get here, for example, in August of last year, 2013, Anton Krasovsky, a TV anchor, came out on the air after having had to report on Putin's new anti-gay crackdown. He was fired immediately, according to theadvocate.com. He said, "I'm gay and I'm just the same person as you, my dear audience, as President Putin." This is what he said on the air. "As President Putin, as Prime Minister Medvedev, as the deputies of our Duma," he said. They literally, then he said later that they immediately blocked all of his accounts. They shut him down. They deleted him. And he says, "The next day I wrote to the network head that I was shocked because it takes them half a day to put up a banner when I asked them to. And here we had such efficiency. One could say they can do what they want to when they want to do it. Now they've put everything back." And so he got fired. I'm wondering if your Russian friends hear a story like that, if that travels news like that.
I don't remember that particular one, but absolutely. I mean, you know, they're just as worried as anybody else is. And during the...
The sites aren't blocked like in China.
No, it's not. You can't. It's not really that easy. I mean,
And they read American sites over there?
You know, when I'm there, I don't really have any trouble getting on anything. So, as far as I can remember. So yeah, there. I mean, it's pretty much. It's not like being in Burma before opening or in North Korea or something like that. I mean, there's. I'm sure there are things they must block, and I'm sure there. You know, there's a lot of surveillance or whatever they're doing, but people have access to pretty much whatever. And, you know, everybody's on Facebook now.
Right.
My friends were, you know, they used to have their own social networks, but now all my Russian friends are on Facebook, you know, posting in Russian. So, you know, but I, you know, I see them all the time on Facebook.
My guest is David Teller here on Out in the Bay. I'm Marilyn Pittman. David is the author of Cracks in the Iron Curtain about LGBT life in the former Soviet Union, and he's the academic coordinator for the master's program in public health and journalism at UC Berkeley.
I could be mistaken, but I remember, if I remember from the Pussy Riot trial, the first one of the trials, that they were actually tweeting from the, you know, people were tweeting the absurdities from in one of the hearings from the courtroom. And, you know, it was like they didn't realize that this nonsense, this preposterousness would be, you know, just immediately broadcast to everywhere.
You know, you were there.
I was only there
in 2012.
Yeah, I was there. I went to Moscow for a week to see friends, and happened to be there. I mean, they'd had a long trial. I happened to be there on the day that the judge was scheduled to read the sentence, the Pussy Riot sentence, and so there was a big gathering of people a couple of blocks down from where the courthouse was. And so, since I was going to be there anyway, I ended up writing a piece about you know, the scene outside the courthouse. And you know, the judge read the verdict for about 3.5 hours, and nobody actually knew what this verdict was until, you know, it was like droning on, and it was really, you know, quite an interesting scene.
I have to just read the opening of your piece. This is on Mother Jones in 2012. This is about covering the sentencing for right. Pussy Riot. No, it starts, "No one reads Anna Karenina these days to find out that poor messed up Anna throws herself under the train. We all know she's done from the moment she sets her eyes on Vronsky." And so it was with the hundreds of people who gathered this afternoon on a leafy street in central Moscow to await the judge's ruling in the Pussy Riot trial. Only an idiot could have doubted that the three young women would be found guilty of anti-religious hooliganism, whatever the hell that is, for their anti-Putin punk rant in Moscow's Central Cathedral. You see them on last night on Colbert?
I read about it. I didn't actually see them, but yeah, they're
hilarious.
Yeah, they're funny. They're performance artists.
They didn't take
artists.
Themselves too seriously. Well, they had they're passionate.
Yeah,
but they had good quips and they had a real punk attitude about it.
Yeah, they're pretty remarkable.
And they're gay, right?
No.
Do we know if they're gay?
No, they're not. No, they're not. I mean, they're one. You know, one's married. I mean, I don't pretend. I don't pretend to know that much about them individually. But but they're very supportive. I mean, they feel like, you know, they're very supportive of the LGBT project, so to speak.
One of the things that happened when Putin initiated these draconian anti-gay laws last summer is that there immediately became a desire to boycott Stoli. Stoli Vodka does a lot of promotion with the gay community. And on the phone from the airport is Patrick Galineau. He's the national brand ambassador for Stoli in the LGBT community. Go ahead, Patrick. How are you? Thanks for calling in. I appreciate it.
Hey, Marilyn, my pleasure. I'm so happy that this bad weather delayed my flight.
Good. I was hoping for that.
Please pardon any of the flight announcements. So, great to be with you.
Thank you so much. So, Patrick, what is, you know, six
I think
months...
Putin arranged.
Putin set it
Putin
up.
Putin set it up that way.
What's the bead right now on, the, you know, what didn't happen, which was the boycott of Stoli didn't really take and didn't really work, did it?
Well, you know, what I have to say is that the boycott certainly, I must say, gave me a couple of gray hairs and made for a very exciting summer. But in retrospect, you know, it really initially was a response by a lot of very passionate people who I feel and my company feel did want to do the right thing, which is help our LGBT brothers and sisters in Russia. And we should keep in mind that we should be trying to help every gay person in every corner of the world who is suffering from prejudice and oppression, and that includes Africa, parts of South America, all around the world. Now, there was a time, of course, when boycotts really did clearly make a difference.
Well, as a reaction, immediately, a lot of the gay bars started dumping their Stoli when this all broke last summer.
Right.
But then it was learned that the vodka is made in the Ukraine, right?
No, it's actually, it is bottled, blended, and shipped from Latvia.
Oh, Latvia.
The Latvia, that's correct. And the headquarters are in Cyprus and in Luxembourg.
It must have given you a few gray hairs, but now things have settled down. There's no anti-Stoli backlash still going on, even though the Olympics are starting.
You know, the community at large has really taken the time to listen and now does understand the history of Stolichnaya. There may be one or two people out there that don't want to let go of it, but as far as Stolichnaya is concerned, nothing has changed about the great support for the gay community that I witnessed over the past 4 years that I've been a part of the brand. And the brand is more committed than ever. As a matter of fact, just last week, I could not be more thrilled that our CEO, John Esposito, released an op-ed at which he formally announced our 3-year and hopefully longer ongoing partnership with the wonderful work of the Los Angeles Gay and Lesbian Center. We at Stolichnaya have pledged $300,000 specifically toward their leadership lab, which helps young members of our community develop skills through mentorship, internships, so that they can go on to cause the sort of change we need to reverse the situation in Russia today.
I like it. I also think that there's somebody out there listening right now, I can hear them, thinking, yeah, well, Stoli, the booze companies want to promote booze and make us drink more because we're so, subject to more drinking than other people because of the oppression we face. How do you deal with those kinds of criticisms when you're dealing with
that's such a great
selling
thing.
Liquor?
You know, I'm so glad that I am the age I am, which, of course, is 22. Actually, no, I'm a member of Generation X. And, you know, I can see from personal experience that the reason why I became so emotionally connected to the brand is because back in the 90s, when really we only had the gay bars to go to before the internet and cell phones and Grindr, and the first brand that I was introduced to was Stoli, and that was a very emotional connection. Mm-hmm. We are a community that tends to have more disposable income, that does drink, and this is one of the great things about Stolichnaya, is that since the bar and nightclub industry has such an important role in our lives, it's different than the straight community. You know, that was the only place we could go. Our bars and clubs were raided. So it's so important and crucial to recognize the companies within nightlife, such as Stolichnaya, and there are others. But when you have a company like Stolichnaya, which is giving unparalleled and unequivocal support for our community, we must remember that there was a time when companies did not speak out, did not give, and we must be careful that through a boycott or other sort of action, we do not discourage companies and then turn back the clock.
Thank you.
In fact, yeah, and we must remember that we have to teach responsibility.
I agree.
If you are going to drink Stolichnaya, of course, but drink responsibly. Don't drink and drive, and certainly enjoy all of our flavors.
Patrick, thank you so much for taking the time out of your schedule to be on the air with us for a few minutes. We're going to get back to David Teller, my guest here on Out of the Bay, but I really appreciate you taking the time. I really do. Thank you, dear.
Always a pleasure. Have fun with David.
Very good.
Have a great night.
Thanks.
Patrick Galineau is the National Brand Ambassador for Stoli for the LGBT community. Thanks for joining us again, Patrick Galineau. It was quite a big deal, man, last summer when it was like, boycott Stoli. And I don't think that was the answer to this, but I also don't think that there's been enough of an answer to this from the corporate sponsors, from Coca-Cola, from, it's not just Coca-Cola, it's Holiday Inn Express, Procter & Gamble, McDonald's, Panasonic, Samsung, these huge multinational corporations that are sponsoring and pouring tons of money into this. Why did they choose Sochi anyway?
Well, I don't know why they chose Sochi anyway. I want to say one thing about the Stoli boycott, which is that, you know, it didn't work as a boycott, but it did work in terms of driving attention to the issue. I mean, I think that's what boycotts are supposed to do.
That's right.
And so whether it was successful as a boycott, boycott doesn't mean it was unsuccessful as a, you know, call for political action, because I think whether you were for it or against it, people were discussing the issue, and I think maybe over time people changed their mind about whether that was the appropriate target. But I think, you know, there is a political, it's too bad for Stoli, but you know, the truth is they have lived on their Russian name, whether they're made in Latvia or whatever. They're, you know, a Russian identified brand.
Yeah.
So it was a very appropriate potential target. And I think, again, in choosing that and in acting on that, I think the activists brought a lot of attention to the issue. That
Cleve Jones and Dan Savage in particular.
Right. That the issue might not have gotten otherwise, or might have taken longer to get.
And it was the beginning. It was the first reaction. It was the first thing people focused on.
Right.
And there's been a lot of focus on Coca-Cola as well, and not enough focus on all the other brands.
Right. Well, there's a separate issue about, you know, sponsoring the Olympics. So, I mean, in a way, these people, I suppose, sponsors, you know, signed up for the Olympics long before they knew that Russia was going to be engaging in this kind of behavior. You know, I don't know what they should be doing, presumably.
Why do they choose Sochi? I mean, he's a tyrant.
You know, you got to ask the International Olympic Committee. I have no
idea.
Well,
they've got a checkered reputation.
They also chose,
well,
you know, Beijing. But, you know, they also chose, you know, the what was it? What was it? It was so corrupt in the U.S. that they had to get cleaned up by Mitt Romney. Salt Lake City, right. So,
well, let's get a little deeper here about this. And maybe you do it in Beijing, you do it in Sochi. Maybe you are bringing consciousness to these regions, to these parts. Maybe you are bringing Western consciousness.
You know, there's always a struggle between trying to exert change from outside and trying to exert change from inside, or trying to exert change through engagement. And there's arguments to be made for both. And people make different decisions about whether they want to be engaged with an oppressive context,
regime,
or whether, and if they can make sort of inroads in some way, and sometimes maybe they can, and, or whether they want to be completely divorced from it and just exert pressure from the outside. I think depending upon the circumstances, both are appropriate, and you actually need both often to get political change. So, you know, all that's to say is, like, I don't know what the answer is in these kinds of circumstances always. I mean, you know, there's a line people cross where obviously you can't condone it.
Well, the president sent Billie Jean King. I thought that was a pretty cool move.
Yeah, that was a very interesting move.
And so you've
got
Billie Jean King there, and you've got gay athletes, who are some of whom are out now,
right,
a little bit more than they ever used to be. You've got gay tourists, gay families of these gay people going. You've got American president. You've got Western people. You've got, think about being there. It just seems to me that maybe for the Russian people and for people from other countries where, like Uganda or places where people, gay people, are completely oppressed and victimized,
mm-hmm,
that maybe just being around gay, maybe they haven't even met any gay people, maybe being around some of this might affect them and, as I said, change consciousness or affect consciousness.
You know, that's possible. I think the outcomes or the, you know, consequences of something like this mass event are very hard to predict. I think in Russia, I mean, the Russians that I spoke with when I was there in the fall, you know, no one I spoke with wanted a boycott of the Olympics. You know, no one I spoke with wanted other countries to boycott the Olympics or ruin the Olympics for Russia. It, you know, even LGBT Russians are often very nationalistic and very, you know, patriotic, like any peoples.
They're proud of their country.
They're proud of their country. And so I think that what to do about the Olympics, you know, is a complicated question. I mean,
what do you think the results are going to be? I mean, have you thought about, you know, I mean, besides the terrorism worries with the toothpaste that we heard about,
mm-hmm,
yesterday, I'm just wondering if you have any take on being such a Russophile and also speaking Russian and having, doesn't your great aunt live in which?
Kazakhstan.
Kazakhstan.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
having friends in Moscow and,
you know, I mean, I worry
you have
about
such deep roots there. I'm just wondering if you have an idea of how this is going to play out in terms of gay consciousness or gay rights?
No, I have no idea. I mean, I don't really have any good feelings about how it's going to play out.
Do you think Putin could have predicted that this would happen, this backlash about the gay thing? Why didn't he wait till next year later this year?
I think the issue with Pussy Riot and the prosecution and the persecution of Pussy Riot really demonstrates that the regime does not have a good feel for what's going to cause controversy in the West. I think that they probably did not expect the outcry from that. The original sentencing request was 6 or 7 years, and the prosecutor then reduced it to 3. then sentenced them to two, then only sentenced two of them, not three. I mean, so they really, you know,
tried to back down,
tried to back down or climb down from that. And I think with the Russia thing, I think they've made the point, you know, we're not discriminating against gay people. We're not outlawing homosexuality. We're just saying we don't want it to be propagandized to our children. And I think from their perspective, they think that's a reasonable position. So I don't think they think or they thought that they would be creating an international situation. Once it happened, they can't really back down.
So are they just, is he out of touch with both the Pussy Riot situation a couple years ago and then this draconian? I mean, I just want, for people that don't know, you're listening to Out in the Bay, I'm Marilyn Pittman, David Tuller is my guest. For people that don't know, it wasn't just, we're not outlawing homosexuality. It was pretty brutal. It signed a law last summer allowing police to arrest tourists and foreign nationals who are gay or support gay activities. It included banning adoption by LGBT people, labeling gays pedophiles. He's big on that. Banning any kind of homosexual propaganda, being arrested for having a rainbow flag, for example.
But remember one thing: these are civil charges for the most part. They're not. Mm-hmm. These are not. You know, it's not like Uganda right now where you know, they just passed the law that they had to they removed the death penalty, but you can still go to prison for life. So, you know, these are still, and again, I mean, I think the effect of these is one of the terrible effects of these is that it basically gives license to whoever. Private citizens to go and, you know, beat people up. There's gangs of sort of thugs doing that now in Russia. They're calling themselves Occupy Pedophilia, and they're kind of luring young gay men, and then they're videotaping it as they beat them up. Ugh. So this has become something that's been going on in Russia. But so the law isn't that, again, the law isn't that the police are going to go breaking into people's homes if they're just sitting at home quietly watching Russian
Idol.
But
the law might
on TV.
Enable that kind of gang behavior.
But the law enables that kind of gang behavior and doesn't give the people any recourse because you're not going to go complain to the police under the circumstances right. That you were gay bashed. So I think
it's not pretty. It's not
no,
good.
It's not a pretty situation. It's
and the corporate sponsors have turned a blind eye to any protests and any awareness. They keep saying on their websites in America, yeah, we support LGBT equality, and then they don't do it. Like Coca-Cola won't put it on their website in Russia.
Well, and IKEA took out changed one of their ads to take out a gay couple. When they showed it in Russia, one of the head of the the creative director of Eurosate, it was something to do with one of the big telephone companies, and who somehow they have a new deal with Apple. He said he would put all gay people in ovens. That happened a few weeks ago.
And what was that?
Ovens. Yeah.
But some people have gone through this thing saying it's like, you know, pre-war 1930s Germany for the gays want to leave. And some gays have left. Some gays have fled for their safety, for their families, their adopted children.
Some gays have left. And, you know, when I talked to people who there were more of them who wanted to. But I think when people in the West, when I would come back to the U.S., people said, did everybody want to leave? And, you know, part of the problem is people want to stay in their home. Most people don't want to leave their countries. They want to be where their parents are and their families are and, you know, where
their
young people, where their languages. They don't want to move to New Zealand or the U.S. Most people, they want to stay where they are, unless they have money or they somehow really think they're going to be able to build another life.
But it has been compared to Nazi Germany.
Yes, it has been compared to Nazi Germany, and I can't say that the comparison is completely inept. You know, there's some basis for the comparison.
So we'll just have to see what happens. The Olympics start tomorrow. David Tuller is my guest here on Out in the Bay. He is an amazing journalist. His work appears in BuzzFeed, Oprah, Slate, New York Times, Salon. His book, Cracks in the Iron Curtain, about LGBT life in the former Soviet Union, came out in the mid-90s. Mm-hmm. And you are the academic coordinator for the Master's Program in Public Health and Journalism at UC Berkeley. Thanks so much for being here, David.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Out in the Bay. It's a program about gay life here in San Francisco. I'm Marilyn Pittman. Hey, check out our Playing Favorites page on outinthebay.com. We put up a dozen of our best shows over these last 8-plus years. Ang Lee, Sylvester, John Waters. Make a donation. It's tax-deductible. Keeps us on the air. Out in the Bay is supported in part by the Bar Association of San Francisco's Lawyer Referral and Information Service, providing legal referrals in over 100 areas of the law, including those most relevant to the LGBT community. Information online at sfbar.org/LRIS. At 415, you can call them 415-989-1616. That's sfbar.org/LRIS. Joanne Marr is our engineer tonight. Eric Jansen and I produce this show. Our thanks to the staff and management here at KALW. I'm Marilyn Pittman. Thank you for joining me.